Welcome to part two, cosmology. So in part one, we did, yeah, not here for cosmology. So in part one, we did, or I scared him away. So in part one, we covered the homogeneous universe. And in part two, we're gonna cover the inhomogeneous universe. So in particular, our first focus is going to be on cosmological perturbation theory. And that basically means FRW plus small fluctuations, okay? So roughly speaking, we split the problem into those two pieces, okay? So first thing we do is we kind of solve for the stage on which the different players are going to act. That's the background FRW universe, which we've spent the last eight lectures or so examining. And then we consider the small fluctuations that live on top of it, but don't affect it, okay? So the key thing here is that there's no back reaction from these small fluctuations onto the geometry of the background. It's just a fixed stage, okay? So there was the background. Okay, so the stage on which these actors are going to play is the Robertson-Walker metric, and I'm just going to consider the flat case. So for all intents and purposes, we live in a pretty darn flat universe, and we're going to forget about curvature. Done. Everything from now on will be flat. Let's make our lives easy. Okay, and to solve for the background, basically all we need to do is to solve the Friedman equation, which we could write in the convenient form in terms of the density parameters. Okay, so in lambda CDM, we have radiation, we have baryons, we have cold dark matter, and we have dark energy. And in the matter sector, we've kind of examined a few different cases. So we have perfect fluids, which are a description of these densities here. And the energy momentum tensor for perfect fluid just had to do with the density pressure and four velocities. We also looked at the distribution function, which was kind of a more fine-grained way of thinking about perfect fluids, maybe when the constituents of that fluid we want to think about as ensembles of particles with some statistics that can interact. And so we also looked at the distribution function. And the distribution function is satisfies the Boltzmann equation, maybe with a collisional term. And then if we have a perfect fluid, we can solve the conservation equation to see how the pressure, density, and four velocity might evolve, right? So that's the background, and we know how to solve that. And so the non-trivial piece that we're going to add to it is this bit about small fluctuations. OK. Okay, so we're going to make the universe not quite homogeneous and isotropic. Okay, so once we make the universe lumpy, then this metric is no longer going to be appropriate. We're going to need to consider deviations from homogeneity, because there's more stuff here than there, and that's going to source gravitational potentials and so on and so forth. So what we can do is we can start with the most general thing possible. So we've got a zeroth order piece, which we're going to say is just the Robertson-Walker metric. And then we're going to have some general perturbation that we add on top of it. So before we do anything else, we can just count, right? So g mu nu is 4 by 4 symmetric matrix. So there should be 10 components in there, functions. Okay. And the most general thing we could do is just to write down a matrix with 10 independent functions in it. Okay. And then start from there. We can do a little bit better in that we can classify the different types of perturbations by how they transform, a lot like we classify particles by their spin. So we can decompose delta G into scalar, vector, and tensor type pieces. That gets a name, it's called the SVT decomposition. And a lot like the way we classify particles of different spin by, for example, how they transform under rotations, we can do the same thing here. Okay? So we can ask, if we rotate, we change a phase, how far does that phase have to go before we come back to the state that I started with? A nice property of this, which we're not going to be able to show because we simply won't have time, but I put a link if you check out Cosmology Part 2's wiki page, there is the first set of notes, and there's a reference in there where you can examine this in more detail. But in linear perturbation theory, we often go to Fourier space. So we could take one of these metric functions . We'll call it Q. And there's a nice proof that says a consequence of translational invariance of the background, meaning homogeneity, is that the Fourier modes of any of these metric functions don't couple. So every K mode evolves independently. You could think of that as, well, if I have a freely propagating particle and it's translationally invariant, what does that imply? It implies there's conservation of momentum, okay? And so a consequence of translation invariance is conservation of momentum, and therefore the different momentum modes of any of these functions, they don't change, right? So they just evolve in time, but I don't ever mix k's. A consequence of rotational invariance of the background, that's isotropy, is that the scalar vector and tensor modes, which I'll define for you in a second, don't mix. So, long story short, there is a basis with which I can write that 4x4 matrix such that in Fourier space, the different K modes don't mix and that the different basis functions don't mix. So it's kind of like going to a sort of diagonal basis, right? Where I can think about fluctuations that are not going to mix into one another. Okay, so then I'll just write for you the correct decomposition in terms of these scalar, tensor, and vector modes. So there's a time-like component here where now all of these things that I've written are in general functions of space and time. So there is a time-like component of the metric that's now not homogeneous. There's a piece that mixes the space and the time up, which was absent in the background FRW. And then there's this piece which tells me how the spatial metric looks. Okay, so these different functions, we need to write some definitions. So this coefficient that mixes up time and space, it's got three components. So I can be 1, 2, 3. Okay, so there's three functions here. And we can choose to decompose these functions in terms of the gradient of a scalar. So that's 1 degree of freedom. And a vector that is divergenceless. Okay, so that would have three components, but then this condition gets rid of one. So there's three independent functions here with this definition. Okay, so this piece here, this you can think of, it's multiplying the spatial metric. So this is like a 3x3 matrix. Okay. Again, that 3x3 matrix has to be symmetric from just our original condition that the metric is symmetric. So this is 1 degree of freedom on the diagonal. And so you can guess that the other degrees of freedom are in this tensor EIJ. So we can decompose this piece into derivatives of a scalar function E, derivatives of a vector function F, and then some leftover piece hij. Okay, and again, there are some conditions that we need to satisfy. So the first condition is that F, again, is a divergenceless vector. Okay. And then H is traceless. So the trace vanishes. and it's transverse. That's not what I want to say. Meaning that the first contracted index derivative is zero. Okay, so then we can count the number of degrees of freedom that are hidden in here. So there's one scalar function. There's two functions here because it's a divergenceless vector. So 3 - 1 = 2. And then there's 2 degrees of freedom in a transverse traceless 3 by 3. Okay. That's also symmetric. Okay, so now we can count. With all those definitions. And we can classify these perturbations. So first of all, there are the scalar ones. So those are all the functions that don't have an index. So there's phi, there's psi, there's this scalar function b, and then there's the scalar function e. Okay, so that's 4 degrees of freedom. Okay, there are the vector perturbations. So that those are the two divergenceless vector functions here. They each have 2 degrees of freedom in them, 2 independent components. So that's 4 degrees of freedom. And then there's the tensor component, Hij, which has 2 degrees of freedom. Okay, and then if we add those up, we get 10. So that's just another way of parameterizing an arbitrary set of 10 independent functions. Here we classify them by their transformation properties, whether they're scalar, vector, or tensor, okay, under spatial rotations.
What about Sij?
Where do you see? Oh, this is a delta function. So that's on the diagonal. Yeah, thanks. Does look like an S. All righty. So that's just some basis that's convenient to work in. So in cosmology, the scalar modes are the ones that grow up into structures, galaxies, and so on and so forth. So those are important. We definitely consider those. The tensor perturbations are gravitational waves. Those are relevant and interesting. We definitely consider those. But vectors decay in time for much the same reason that peculiar velocities in an expanding FRW decay with time. And so typically we don't talk about vector modes in cosmology because if we started with some initial amplitude of vector modes, they would just decay away very quickly. Like 1/(scale factor)2, I believe, but I could be wrong about that. So the only time you'll ever hear me talk about vectors is right now. We just won't talk about them again. Okay. Now the major caveat or complication. So we have these 10 degrees of freedom, but I can reparameterize my coordinates in an arbitrary way. And so there's really 4 constraints. So I can choose what I mean by T, X, Y, Z. Okay? And so really there's only six physical degrees of freedom. And that's a major complicating factor because it means that there are many different physically equivalent situations that I can write down that might look totally different at the level of the metric, right? So I could have very different metrics that actually correspond to the same exact physical situation. In fact, an infinite number of them, because I have functions. I have like, I really have a lot of freedom to pick all the different functions there. So we call this situation gauge dependence. A gauge is a particular choice of a coordinate system, okay? And so the particular metric that I write down is totally gauge dependent. Observables, so things that I actually observe, are gauge independent. Right? So that's one of the fundamental tenets of general relativity, diffeomorphism invariance, that I can write my physical situation, describe it in any coordinate system I want, but as long as I focus on things that I can actually observe, should not matter what coordinate system I choose. I always will get the same physical answer, right? Now, partially for historical reasons and partially for reasons of familiarity, typically we don't do cosmology in a way that makes this manifest. So we could have a course where we formulate cosmology entirely in terms of gauge-independent observables. But we don't usually work that way. So instead, we work with gauge-dependent quantities, where we fix a gauge, fix a coordinate system, and then do our computations, and then chug through a bunch of steps, and at the end, we get an observable, like the CMB anisotropies or something. And we just, you know, rest assured that if we had started from the beginning and we chose a different gauge, we would have gotten the same observables. Historically speaking, again, that path caused a lot of problems and complications early on because it turns out that one of the most easy to work with and popular coordinate choices in cosmology has things that blow up and is sort of generally speaking poorly behaved, and people thought that was physical for a while, and so they were sort of sidetracked by this, but it's just like the event horizon of a black hole. It's just so, okay, well, you just chose silly coordinates to work in, and then that's the whole reason for all these complications that you have. But anyway, we will follow the historical route. We will not choose a fully gauge-independent formalism, but we will just work with these gauge-independent quantities. So I just wanted to say that, so you know that that exists. And I had a really great psi student four or five years ago that worked out a lot of things in this formalism. So that's a field of active research. Did you have a question?
Yeah. It's if we're interested in the physics of what's happening in our universe, if you were to choose coordinates that depend on what physical content I put in, then I fix my gauge, but I'm also saying, oh, but this is, I don't have a problem of not doing the same physics because I choose something that depends on what's inside my universe.
Mm-hmm.
They say, yeah, follow the wall lines of every particle and everywhere, then it depends on my matter content at the beginning, so my metric looks different, but because I have a different physics, so that's okay.
Many of the gauge choices that we will make are inspired by physical conditions, so you can do that, but I could always come along with some perverse coordinate system and be like, well, I want all my particles to travel at 0.98 the speed of light. And let's choose a weird coordinate system where everything has the same velocity. You know, like I could always come along and change the coordinate system on you. And we'd be back to square one. On the other hand, so there are things that are really like gauge independent, you know, for example, the Ricci scalar. Or the distribution function, another great example of something that's gauge invariant if we formulate it with the right definition of X and P. So yeah, those are the things that you'd really want to work with if you wanted to work with something that was truly coordinate independent. Okay, so like keep that in the back of your mind. That's really the major complicating factor of cosmological perturbation theory, is the fact that there are just many different coordinate choices that we can make. Okay, so that was just the first part. That was just the analog of FRW, perturbing FRW, but we also have to perturb the matter degrees of freedom. Right, so we have to consider the fact that the densities and pressures might not be completely uniform. So the form of the energy momentum tensor will remain the same. It's still going to look like a perfect fluid. But now we're going to allow the pressure and the density and the four velocity to not be entirely homogeneous. So we could consider that the pressure, or sorry, the density is a mean density, which is just a function of T times 1 plus delta, which can be a function of both position and time. We defined this before. That's just the overdensity, so the density compared to the average. For this course, we're just going to assume that the pressure is W times rho. Okay? So the pressure is W rho bar 1 plus delta. This is an assumption that doesn't necessarily need to be true, but is true to a very good accuracy in our universe. If we make this equality, we're assuming that the perturbations are adiabatic. Okay, so that's this assumption that we don't have any relative mixing that cancels out the total density. And then we have the four velocity, which we're going to write as the FRW piece. That's just that particle sit there. So the four velocity is just one and a bunch of zeros, plus a perturbation. And again, that perturbation can depend on both position and time. So it turns out that this language is most useful for the baryons and dark matter, but that it's more useful to think in terms of the distribution function for photons and neutrinos. So we could also consider perturbing the distribution function. So again, if we're just considering relativistic particles, there's the momentum, that's the energy, right? We could consider a temperature that's a function of time, and then we can add an arbitrary function of time and the position on phase space, x and p. And plus minus one, depending on whether or not I'm talking about photons or neutrinos. This quantity here, so it's a function of time, space, and momentum. which is going to be the object that's going to tell us about the temperature anisotropies of the CMB, for example, as observed at different places. It tells us how the temperature of the photons depend on position, time, momentum. Okay, so we can then write down a list of the important variables that we're going to need at the end of the day, right? In the matter sector. So we've got the density of baryons. We've got the four velocity of baryons. We've got the density of cold dark matter. We've got the four velocity of cold dark matter. And then we've got this perturbation to the distribution function for photons and the perturbation to the distribution function for neutrinos. So those are the relevant players for the matter sector. And we could count them. So there's one here. There's going to be, it turns out, three independent things in here, basically the three velocities, and then you have a normalization condition that fixes the time component. So there's 4 plus 4, 8 plus 2. Okay, this is going to be 10, basically 10 independent functions that we need in the matter sector as well. That's a coincidence. That 10 doesn't have anything to do with this 10, because if I didn't have baryons, it would have been 6. Okay, so that's a coincidence. But anyway, there's 10 independent functions that we need to specify perturbations in the matter sector. Okay. Well, and then the name of the game, okay, so we've written down all the variables, but we need to know now how they evolve, okay? So we have Einstein's equations. We can look at how perturbations in the Einstein tensor are related to perturbations in the stress tensor. Okay, so this is going to tell us about how the 6 independent degrees of freedom in the metric behave as a function of time. We have the conservation law for perturbations in the stress tensor. And then we have the Boltzmann equation for the distribution functions. Okay. So these are the relevant laws of dynamics for cosmological perturbation theory.
Yeah, I have a question. When we choose u mu, like delta u mu to be the perturbation with the time lag, the perfect time lag trajectory, mm-hmm. don't we have a problem if we consider two species? Like, because one would, if I'm saying, okay, I want to be in the coordinates where all my baryons go this way, mm-hmm. and my dark matter is maybe going another way. Isn't that a problem sometimes?
It's not a problem, but in that situation, you'd never be able to choose a coordinate system where everything was at rest. That is true. Yeah.
So.
In fact, in our universe, there's an interesting but sort of tiny effect that is a relative velocity between baryons and cold dark matter. And that's a physical thing that we hope to observe someday. So that is just a physical situation that can occur.
So which coordinates do we choose?
Oh, but that's the art of doing cosmology, is choosing the right coordinates. We haven't even gotten there which the choices are. But we can list at least 6 or 7 different kinds of choices of coordinates that can be interesting in different situations. Yes. But that's part of the cooking. That's you know, like What's the best choice of coordinates to make a calculation really easy? I mean, in GR, that's really like, that's the art of doing GR. If you want to solve things by brute force, you just write down all those partial differential equations and throw it on a computer and solve it. But choosing the right system of coordinates, well, led Schwarzschild to find the black hole solution, the FRW solutions, De Sitter. All of these things were manifested by choosing the right coordinate system that reflected the physical symmetries of those spacetimes. Even for black hole mergers, people bang their heads against the wall to get black holes to merge on a computer until someone came along and found the right coordinate system that made it work. So the art of GR is finding the right coordinate system. I cannot tell you how to be an artist. You have to learn how to be an artist. So these are the laws of dynamics for cosmological perturbation theory. They need initial conditions. Okay, so in the standard cosmology, those initial conditions are provided by this theory of inflation that we talked about at the end of part one. We can feed those initial conditions into these dynamical laws, and then from the evolution of all these different variables, we can figure out how structures grow. So before things become nonlinear and collapse into galaxies and clusters of galaxies and so on and so forth, we can learn how the inhomogeneities evolved into the seeds of those galaxies and structures. We get the CMB, anisotropies, baryon acoustic oscillations, and so on and so forth. The laundry list of all the interesting things that we compute in cosmology come from putting these initial conditions into these dynamical laws and then combining the outcomes in different ways. So that's like the program, okay? Initial conditions, figure out how these dynamical laws work, and then calculate observables. Okay. And so this intermediate step, these are all things we can observe. Okay, but this intermediate step can be done in many, many, many different ways according to which choice of coordinates you choose, or if you formulate everything in terms of gauge-independent things or whatever. This intermediate step has got a lot of freedom in what to do. Okay, so now that I've kind of sketched everything, let's go back and go into the mud and talk about some of these issues in a little bit greater detail. So first, let's talk about this issue of gauge dependence. And I think that'll pretty much eat up most of this lecture. And then next time, we'll talk about the dynamics. So we'll write down the dynamical laws. And then we'll proceed to first go in this direction and calculate the growth of structure and the CMB anisotropies. And then at the end, we're going to loop back and we're going to talk about these initial conditions. And that's sort of the plan for part two. OK, so first, gauge dependence. So first, let's draw a picture to represent homogeneous FRW. So here's time, and here's position. If we look at the surfaces of constant time in homogeneous FRW, the surfaces of constant time are also the surfaces of constant density, right? So there is a magical coordinate system of FRW that make everything simple, which is the one on which I choose time to be the surfaces of constant density. And then I fix space by taking a bunch of positions and then sending out particles that just sit there. Oh God, that was terrible. Okay, and then having this set of particles define what I mean by position. Just start particles at a given fixed separation and let them just sit there. And that defines my position. And the four velocity is just the simple one where they just sit there. Okay, we can see that T is just the T is just the proper time experienced by each of these particles that are just sitting there. And I can think of X as a label on this ensemble of test particles, right? It's just how far apart were they at some initial time. That can be my definition of what X is. Okay, so that is homogeneous FRW. We can consider a perturbed FRW that's not quite homogeneous. So we could recycle the definition that I have here for the coordinate system. Okay, but now if I recycle that definition and, for example, I have a density that's not exactly the same everywhere, if I look at these surfaces of constant time, then they may no longer be surfaces of constant density. Okay, so now the density changes depending on where I am, and it might evolve in time. So one thing we can imagine doing is let's pick a constant time, let's say this one, and let me just bend my surface of constant time upper town by an amount that depends on position, okay? So I just add a little bit of time here, subtract a little bit of time over here. You can see that by manipulating the time coordinate in this sort of position-dependent way, that is possible to go to a new coordinate system where now, in terms of this initial background set of coordinates, we have this new time where rho as a function of x and this new time is now constant. Okay. So we can go to a new coordinate system where I change my hypersurfaces so that they're now hypersurfaces of constant density. And it's always possible to do that, right? I can make any crazy distribution of density I want, and I can always make a coordinate change that take me to a coordinate system where the density is everywhere constant. So, you know, usually you're used to thinking about density as like a physical observable. There's either more stuff here or there is not. But here you can clearly see that that's totally a coordinate system dependent statement. Now, when I did this, what necessarily happened is that I changed my slicing, okay? So here, this slicing you can see is flat, it's not curved. But the price of doing this coordinate change is now that my slices have curvature. So I can go to a system of coordinates where the density is constant, but now the curvature of these slices is not zero, and it's also not necessarily constant. Because I have to bend the surfaces more where there's more matter, so they're going to get more curved, right? And so, you know, if you like, you made a gravitational potential, but you didn't do it in any for any physical reason because there was stuff gravitating, but it's just entirely from this change of coordinates, right? So both the matter and the metric variables, I hope this demonstrates for you, are totally coordinate system dependent. Okay, so we can now formalize these pictures in math by remembering how tensors transform under coordinate changes. So if we have the metric as a function of some set of coordinates, or at this level it's totally arbitrary what they are, I can go to a new system of coordinates. We'll label them by a tilde, by applying the tensor transformation law. And I'll get some new metric functions that are going to be a function of this new set of coordinates. Okay, so sort of formal level, this is what we mean by doing a gauge transformation or doing a coordinate transformation, going from one picture to another. All right, so let's consider some parameterization of this coordinate change. So we can write my new set of coordinates as the old ones plus some function, okay, which in general could be a function of my old set of coordinates. This, if you like, is that bending of the time variable that I drew here. Okay. Okay, so with this definition, we can just evaluate this expression. So first we have these partial derivatives, okay? So dx tilde dx mu is just gonna give me a delta function. So I'll get delta a mu. And then I'll also get a derivative with respect to x mu of this function c. So I'm going to use that as shorthand for that from now on to save myself some writing. Okay, so that's this first factor. We've got this second factor, which again gives me some delta function and some derivative of this free function. Okay, and then we have our metric, which if we think in terms of perturbed Robertson-Walker, we can write as a FRW plus a small correction, right? So we could write this as a zeroth order metric, which we're going to assume if the coordinate changes that we're making are small, is just whatever the FRW metric was in the original coordinate system, so nothing happens with that. And then, if again, we consider our coordinate transformation to be small, we can have the perturbations let me write down more explicitly what these things are a function of. So this is a function of the original coordinates. We can have perturbations of the metric, which again, we can consider to be functions of the original coordinates. And then we can Taylor expand around the new set of coordinates. So we can Taylor expand around x mu so that we get the derivative of our original metric function, the FRW1 times this small change in coordinates. Okay, so we basically do a Taylor expansion of the metric perturbations around this new set of coordinates. And to leading order, that's what this coordinate change does in small parameters. Okay, so we can evaluate this and we can throw away all the terms that are higher than first order in either Xi or delta G. So this guy can hit this guy with the original metric and we just get back the FRW piece. This delta function can hit this derivative, which can then hit the backgrounds. So we can get a piece that goes like d nu xi b times g mu b in FRW. We can get a piece where this derivative hits that delta function. So we get a d mu xi a times the FRW metric. And then we can have the metric perturbations. But since Xi is small, we can't multiply by Xi again. So that just gets hit by the delta functions. So then we get a, that's the perturbed metric, because it had a twiddle to indicate that it was perturbed in the new coordinate system. So this is G twiddle mu nu. Okay, and again, we evaluate this at the old coordinates. And then we have this correction piece that was the Taylor expansion that told me how to make that small coordinate change. So then finally, this just gets hit with the delta function, so we don't get a piece that's higher order. So this looks like d mu, d gamma, g mu nu, xi gamma. Okay. To leading order, this is what this coordinate transformation does. Okay. So on the left-hand side, we've got our original metric, the FRW1, plus the perturbations. So now we could solve this expression for what the coordinate transformed metric perturbations look like. So we cancel off the background piece. And we stick this on the right side and we stick that on the left side so that we just get the transformed metric perturbations. Are going to be equal to the original metric perturbations minus all these other pieces. Okay, so that is to leading order. So assuming delta G is small and that C is small. Okay. To first order, that's what the coordinate transformation does. Furthermore, all a function of the original coordinate system, evaluated at that original coordinate system. Question.
It's just to clarify, the first equality, like G mu equals something in G tilde,
yep.
Is we have two perturb matrix, and we change coordinates to go from one to the other. So they're both not the FRW. We're not going from FRW to something with two inhomogeneous.
Yes, we have two inhomogeneous universes, and we have two coordinate systems describing an inhomogeneous universe. Okay, so then we can focus on the scalar components because as it turns out, the tensor components don't really do anything interesting under this change of coordinates. So they don't change. So if we were to write out the metric as a function of only the scalar pieces, that's what we have. And now we could go through. So we have the scalar pieces. And then we could look at the components of C. So for scalar functions, it will be enough for us to have C parameterized by a time shift and a divergenceless vector. And a curl-free position shift. So I'm not going to do any kind of rotations. I'm just going to do scaling in and out, so things that have a divergence, in which case we could write the components, the spatial components, as the gradient of a scalar. So let's assume that is enough to describe these scalar transformations of these scalar metric functions. You could think of it also as follows, like if I do a rotation, it's a scalar. Nothing happens, right? So it's enough to consider irrotational coordinate changes. No rotations. Okay, so we could go through now component by component and evaluate this thing up here, which I will leave to you to do in your tutorial on Thursday. But the result you'll get at the end of the day is this. Okay, so this time thing, this perturbation multiplying the time-like component changes by this time shift, the time derivative of that time shift in the coordinate. B. Changes by that time shift over A plus A times C dot. Okay, so it has to do with both the time and the space shift. Psi is the Hubble parameter times the time component of the coordinate shift. And E is E plus the space component of the coordinate shift. Okay. So this just comes from evaluating this tensor transformation law with this definition for the metric. Okay. So that's just a crank to turn. Okay, and given that, we can now write down some different choices of coordinate systems. Okay, so you'll notice here we have four scalar functions, and then we have two free choices for these functions here, okay? So it's always possible for me to choose these functions in order to eliminate two of these scalar functions. There's always a coordinate system in which I can choose to eliminate any two I want, okay? Which is excellent. So I can reduce the number of free functions that I need to solve for just by choosing the right set of coordinates. Super convenient. And that allows me to define some different gauges. So let's just define two. So there's the Newtonian gauge, where I choose to set B and E to zero. Okay, so then I get a diagonal metric. That depends on only these two functions here, right? If you remember back to your GR course, this in the non-relativistic limit gave me the Newtonian potential, right? So just like for Schwarzschild, you can read off the Newtonian potential from the time-time metric component. So that's convenient coordinate system to use for that reason only. And then psi here tells you about the curvature of the spatial slices. So if you define a three-dimensional metric from this piece here, and you calculate the Ricci scalar, the three-dimensional Ricci scalar is just the Laplacian of psi over 4a squared. Question?
But then if we want to say that phi on phi is the Newtonian potential, don't we need it to be related to the curvature of the whole space? I mean, so if I already have spatial curvature, maybe phi is something, because of psi, phi is not really the Newton potential.
It is the Newtonian potential. There's no problem with that. Just like in Schwarzschild, you also had a coefficient in front of the space part that looked exactly like the coefficient in front of the time part. But it still is true that in the non-relativistic limit, this is the thing that appears in the Poisson equation.
No psi.
No psi. Yeah, psi has interesting information in it, and sort of the geometrical information that it carries is this. So it's telling me on that picture up there that I drew, what is the curvature of the slices? So what is the intrinsic curvature of those spatial slices? If you keep that in the back of your mind, for later, will make more sense and be more helpful. But just to know that that's kind of the information encoded in here. Okay, another important and interesting gauge. This is the dangerous one I was telling you about. It's the so-called synchronous gauge. So in the synchronous gauge, we want to set phi and b equal to 0 so that the only place that I see time is just here. In other words, time is just the proper time of observers at a constant position. So this is kind of a nice coordinate system because we just have an ensemble of observers. I measure their proper time. And again, I can label their positions by these xi's. And then the resulting curvature of those surfaces is, again, specified by this curvature perturbation, psi. And then we have, but then we have this extra piece to contend with, this weird derivatives of e piece. OK, but it's there. OK, so those are two popular choices of coordinate systems. And we'll talk about some other ones eventually. But just to have them in your mind, those are two. We can also define gauge invariant, meaning at first order in these coordinate changes. Variables, okay? Those are called the Bardeen potentials. And so if I write down the following peculiar combination of metric functions in any gauge I want, and you apply the tensor transformations using these definitions, you'll find that nothing happens to these variables. And again, that will be an exercise for your tutorial on Thursday to try out. So they're gauge invariant in the sense that they're independent of C under coordinate change. But if we were to consider at higher order, if we were to make a big coordinate change, then this wouldn't be true anymore. So this is only at linear order. That's one thing to keep in mind. Question.
So there was a tensor for hij.
Correct.
So it is absent because considering first order?
Yeah, so at first order in coordinate changes, one can show that in your tutorial on Thursday. It is independent of the coordinate system. So it's also independent of xi at first order. Yeah. Okay, any other questions about the gravity sector?
Mm-hmm. Once again, if we have different species, like we have electrons, we have photons.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah, you know, it feels. If I'm choosing the proper time of each particle, then I wouldn't be able to see differences between the behavior of the two evolution of the two species. I don't know.
So you'd have to pick a species to be your particle. So let's say it's dark matter and baryons again. So let's say that dark matter and baryons have a relative velocity. I could make a synchronous coordinate system. I could make a synchronous gauge coordinate system by saying I want all the dark matter particles. I want to follow the geodesics of all the dark matter particles, and I want to measure their proper time. Well, then in the synchronous gauge, it's just that the baryons would be moving. There would be no way of defining coordinate system where both were at rest. Yeah. That's it. Yeah?
So there must be a coordinate system that corresponds to what we as observers would measure observables in?
Yep.
Is that like what?
So if we're co-moving, we have geodesic motion, then the appropriate gauge would be the synchronous one. So if we forgot about the fact that we're orbiting the sun and the sun is orbiting the galaxy, but if we were just floating out in free space and expanding with the expansion of the universe in the presence of, you know, small perturbations, then we would be in the synchronous gauge, more or less. Yeah.
Do people, like, when we do measurement, do we assume that we on Earth observer are certain things in this gauge, or we need to take into account the fact that we are accelerating?
Yeah, we do, because when I look at the CMB, I see a big old dipole. And that's really mostly due to my peculiar motion with respect to the rest frame of the CMB. And most of that peculiar motion is coming from things like orbiting the galaxy and the galaxy falling into the Andromeda galaxy. And so, for sure, you have to take that into account. Although, the way we take that into account in the CMB is to subtract off the dipole. Yeah. Interestingly, you can measure the dipole in two different ways. One way is directly, and the other way is because if you're moving, there's a relativistic aberration effect that causes things to move towards your direction of motion. So if you've got a bunch of spots on the sky, you'd see that the spots are more concentrated in your direction of motion and more diffuse opposite your direction of motion. And people have measured the peculiar motion of us with respect to the CMB rest frame using that observation, basically, by seeing how much more concentrated are the splotches in one direction on the sky, and okay, we must be moving that way. And that more or less coincides with this other direct dipole, just the Doppler effect that I observe in the CMB. And then you can ask, well, how well does that correlate with our motion towards Andromeda and our current position, you know, as we orbit the galaxy? And it correlates pretty well. So yeah, you can measure this, and people talk about doing that, for sure. Other questions? Okay. All right, so then let's get started on the matter sector. Not sure we'll get it to the end, but we'll try. So we'll focus for the moment on the perfect fluid case. I told you it's also useful to think about photons and neutrinos in terms of the distribution function, but we'll postpone that for a little while. Okay, so we have perfect fluids where we said that the density is a mean times 1 plus delta. And the pressure is just W rho. Really, we should give each of these an index. and sum over the different species, yeah? But we'll be a little bit sloppy and we'll not do that now, okay? But if I want to answer all of your questions about the relative velocities, then I'd have to do that, okay? But for now, let's just forget about that. Okay, and then we have the four velocity. So the four velocity we said was just the FRW part. We can also have a perturbation in the time-like component. And let's define the space-like part of the four velocity with this V over A. Okay, so this is the same velocity we met before when we talked about the distribution function. All right. So right off the bat, here there's four free parameters, but we know that there's a normalization condition, so we should be able to get rid of one. So if we do that, there's the time-like component, which was minus 1 plus 2 psi times the time-like component of u, which was just 1 plus delta u squared. And then we have to sum up the space parts, okay? But the space-like part of the four velocity, we're going to imagine v is also a small variable. And so if we want to work to leading order, we can forget about the spatial perturbations in the perturbed metric and just write the Robertson-Walker piece. So that just gives us an a squared from gij. Gij is a delta function. And then we've got v over a squared. So those a's cancel out nicely. So then if we multiply this out, we've got minus 1 minus 2 phi minus 2 delta u from squaring. And then there will be higher order terms that are second or third order in the perturbation. So we're going to throw them away, say they're small. And then finally, we've got this, which is also second order in the perturbation. So it's going to be thrown away. It's small. So at a first order, this is what we have. And in order for the left-hand side to equal the right-hand side, then it had better be true that this time-like perturbation in the four velocity is just given by phi, minus phi. All right, so then we know how to write u mu. Is just 1 minus phi, and then the three velocities. You could lower an index to get the lower u. Again, working to first order, you get a minus phi. I'll let you do that on your own. Okay, if you lower u, you get that. Okay, again, if we have scalars, there's no source for rotation, so you get a purely irrotational flow. So that means we could write the vector for the three velocities as the gradient of a scalar, okay? It's curlless, so we can write v vector as the gradient of a scalar. And now you could just take all this and substitute into the stress tensor. We'll get that t mu nu is going to be given by a zeroth order piece. That's just the usual one in FRW, plus perturbations. And we could write out explicitly what those perturbations are. And then I think we'll call it quits for the day. Yeah, so the 0, 0 component will just be rho plus p, u0, u0 plus p. If you work that out with all the definitions we have up there, you just get minus delta times rho bar. There's going to be a 0i piece. Again, if you work it out, you get the following. Okay, so that's related to the velocity and this B metric function. You'll get an I0 piece. It's not exactly the same. It doesn't have to be symmetric when one of the indices is up and down. There you get minus rho bar 1 plus W V over A. And then finally, there's a space, space piece. And that's diagonal. It's the density perturbation times the equation state parameter times the mean density. All right, so these are the perturbations of the stress tensor. That's like the analog of the perturbed metric we have up there. So that defines for us the form of this perturbed stress tensor. Okay. And then next time we'll ask how this transforms under coordinate changes. That will allow us to come up with another creative set of gauge choices. Okay. And once we have done that, then we can go on to talk about the dynamical laws and figure out how all these variables that we've just defined evolve. Okay. But like up to now, it's really just been setting the stage, defining the variables, and thinking about the most informed coordinate systems. One logistical note, or two logistical notes before we quit. I forgot if I mentioned it, but the wiki is now different. It is now part two. And the first set of notes you will find on that wiki. Don't forget about your homework assignment from part one, which is due today, nominally. There will be a new homework assignment. Again, there's two homework assignments for the second part. So that will be posted soon, hopefully tomorrow. And then the other component is that each of you will pick from a list of papers that will also appear on the wiki very shortly, a classic, something you'd like to read that is a classic paper in cosmology. And then the last two lectures will be you presenting for 15 minutes on that paper. So I hope that this is a good way for you to get engaged in improving your public speaking ability and also in learning about a topic on your own. And then eventually you have to get up in front of someone, of people in the audience, and present your essays. So this is a good practice for that. All right, but that will be appearing soon.